My name is Bob Baker, and this is the first of five sessions dealing with the book by Walter Brueggemann, The Bible Makes Sense. And it's a discussion book study, five sessions. Now, some people just joined us. Has anyone here read any of the books by Walter Brueggemann? Okay. Outside of James, anybody heard the name? Recognized it at all?
You've heard the name. Last year I was here, so I heard the name.
You heard the name last year. That's good. There is a set of three tapes in the lending library. They are done by Joel Oinas, so they're under OI and then J. And it's 82.3, 82.4, and 82.5. It's a previous discussion of this book. That means it was done in 1982. That's how the numbers are. Walter Brueggemann was here at the village in the fall of 1975 and delivered three lectures at that time, and those are entitled The Enculturation of the Church. So he was here in 75. The copyright date of this book is 77. So this book is kind of similar in time to those lectures. And I mentioned those. They're available in the lending library. They're also available in the bookstore for sale, any of the tapes are. At least up until this past winter, those three tapes by Brueggemann have outsold consistently any other tape or set of tapes that have been sold through Holden Village Tape Ministry. So that gives you some flavor of the popularity of Brueggemann's material once people do get acquainted with him. And certainly I'm excited about his material, and I've put together a 7-page bibliography of his writings that includes books, contributions to reference books, anthologies, journal articles, and book reviews. That is, when he reads somebody else's material and writes a review of it. And that was as of November 85, and he's continuing to write, and my bibliography is out of date. But it gives you a sense of his writing. He is he's an ordained minister of the United Church of Christ, so I'm not going around waving just Lutheran flags. Any UCC folks here? Okay. He has been an Old Testament professor at Eden Theological Seminary, where he himself went to school. He has a Doctor of Theology degree from Union Seminary in New York City, and a Doctor of Education degree from St. Louis University. His title, his most recent position at Eden Seminary, was Evangelical Professor of Biblical Interpretation. So that gives you something of a flavor for who this person is. The title of the book as printed here is The Bible Makes Sense, and the question that I'm asking for this session, and I'll make a few comments and then we can open it up for discussion, hopefully. The question I'm asking out of this session is, which of these three titles up here is the title of the book? Of course, it's not printed that way, but if we were to read those, the first one up there would say something like this: The Bible Makes Sense. That is, the emphasis in a good Southern Baptist style is on the Bible. And you could maybe put BG after that, Billy Graham. The Bible Makes Sense is the second one. I really don't know who I could, what character I could put up with that one. The third one, The Bible Makes Sense, if that's true, that would belong, let's say, a proponent would be somebody like Mr. Spock. That is, the emphasis is on what is reasonable, intelligible, rational. And maybe you can suggest somebody we'd put up with the second of those three. And if not now, by the end of the session, say. I want to relate three dissimilar items as something of a background for dealing with the first chapter, which is maybe the most difficult of the chapters in this book. The first time that I tried to read it, I got through the first chapter and I put the book down and I didn't pick it up for 6 weeks. And I really am a fan of Walter Brueggemann. And so one recommendation is if you try to, or if you want to read a book, if you do, I hope you do, don't read the first chapter until you've read the rest of the book, then go back and read the first chapter. It makes more sense. Or maybe after this evening, you'll be able to read the first chapter and it won't be quite so thick. But he does attempt to cover a lot of ground in the first chapter. And so a great deal is said in a short space, and sometimes that makes it rather thick going. But three stories as background for what's going on in the first chapter. The first account was a story told by one of the staff presenters 3 weeks ago with LCA Youth Weekend here. The story was told about a research project done with kittens. There were three batches of kittens, and they were raised for 6 weeks from birth. One batch was in a box, an environment where everything was, all the lines were horizontal. And certainly all the horizontal lines that were in the box or in their container, they were emphasized. So they were marked out. It was, you know, very obvious. And when those kittens were taken out of that environment at an age of 6 weeks, they were very agile in terms of jumping up on chairs, counters, furniture. They coped very well with horizontal lines, but they kept bumping into the legs of chairs and tables. The vertical lines, they weren't sensitive to, they weren't alert to, and they couldn't cope with. Another batch of kittens was raised in an environment where the vertical lines were accentuated. And after 6 weeks, when they were taken out, why, they didn't bump into any chair legs or table legs or anything else that was vertical, but they stayed on the floor. You know, none of them would jump up onto a chair or onto anything higher. Their sensitivity, alertness to horizontal dimensions was absent. And then there was a third group. They were raised where everything was in dots. And I don't recall what happened to them. But the point of it was that their environment was very influential for their worldview, I would call it. Maybe a little more sophisticated than you'd want a lot for a cat. But what they were sensitive to was highly shaped by their environment, their formative environment of the first 6 weeks. Okay, that's just file that one away, and we'll come back to it or have that as a backdrop for what follows. The second account is about a research project done by the Missouri Synod. I won't ask for a show of hands. I grew up in the Missouri Synod. The Missouri Synod has a lot of parochial schools. What is it? Every three congregations, or there's a parochial school. It's either a day school or an elementary school, junior high, high school. They have so many parochial schools. There's one for every three congregations. So the Missouri Synod is very heavily invested in the education of the youth, besides Vacation Bible School and confirmation programs and Sunday school programs and all the rest of it. So they did an extensive research project to find out how effective this process was. And the results could be one of the results, most noteworthy of it, could be summarized this way. Any individual, any given person, we can say they have 1,000 units of moral value. It doesn't say anything about what's the content of those units of moral value, just everybody has 1,000 units. The question then is, well, where did you get what you do have as units of moral value? And 550, or 55%, however you'd want to word it, 550 of those 1,000 are values that a child gets from their parent. The actual content of certain values may differ, but the basic dynamic of it, the orientation of it, is shaped 550 out of 1,000 by one's parents, guardian, significant other, whoever the surrogate parent, other than parent. So the Missouri Synod was quite interested in knowing, well, how many of the remaining 450 do they shape? You know, what does the church do? And one of the trial cases was, well, what about children whose parents bring them to church or send them to school, but they themselves, the parents that is, are not involved in some kind of adult education, parochial education, church involvement? Well, how many do you think out of the 450 such youngsters the church gave? Pick a number, anybody?
12.
12, okay. What?
25.
25, 12. 25 is still quite generous. 12 is trying to get under it, but you didn't. still smaller than that.
Lower than 12?
Lower than 12.
8?
Lower yet. 3. 3. The influence factor, the effectiveness factor of parochial education on children whose parents themselves were not involved in such processes was 3 out of 1,000. Well,
what about parents who go to the church and send their children?
Well, okay, now you see you're not asking what's the influence of the church. You've got a compound factor. There's the influence of the parents, see, and that carries 550. So that would go up considerably. But now it's factored by the parental involvement. Well, needless to say, that study was quickly tabled, was shelved by the Missouri Synod, who has a tremendous financial investment, property investment in parochial education. Those kind of results aren't something that encourages us to continue doing what we're doing. Well, okay, I can say quite a bit about that one, but I want to just now file that one, hold that one with the horizontal and vertical lines, the kittens, that's right. But it's hard for me to let go of that. You really see the influence that the parents have. Yeah. My argument is, and some people have said, well, one person has said, Sunday school is an inoculation against Christianity. I've kind of said, well, the best parochial education program is the one that's conducted by the parents. I mean, I want, in some kind of a confirmation program or whatever, to have the parents on the same team as what the church is trying to teach. Because then the influence of the church isn't a factor of 3, it'd be like 553, Now that's statistical, of course, and there are exceptions to the rule, and all of us know somebody who, you know, differed from the norm, but statistically, that's what we're dealing with, and who really wants to design a parish education program to deal with exceptions, you know, okay. The third item that I want to relate to you is a book by Philip Reif. The title of the book is called the main title is Triumph of the Therapeutic. Triumph of the Therapeutic, subtitled Uses of Faith After Freud. The point of the book is that church and going to church and having churches in the community and sending our youngsters to Sunday school is healthy. That's what it means by the triumph of the therapeutic. It's healthy for society. So Philip Reif, the author of the book, is very much for churches. Really argues very strongly that we ought to have churches. It's good for us to have churches. It's good for society to have churches. Philip Reif is at least an agnostic, if not an atheist. Philip Reif really doesn't believe in God. But that's aside from the point as far as Philip Reif is concerned. The church and the function of the church in culture is like the mortar that holds the bricks of a building together. So it is therapeutic, it is healthy, it is in the interest of society to have religion and to have churches. But that isn't, you know, it doesn't matter that God doesn't exist for Philip Reif. What counts is what's good for culture, for our society. Okay. Those are three things that I want to just kind of shoot out there as background material for trying to get into the first chapter of Brueggemann's book, The Bible Makes Sense. The next thing I want to do is paraphrase three paragraphs of a journal article that Brueggemann wrote. The journal article is called "As the Text Makes Sense." So I'm trying to get inside the question, well, which of these three titles is the title of the book? And what's he trying to say? Because the title of the book is very deliberate, it's very intentional, and if we understand the title of the book, then the rest of the book start to fall into place very easily, and it's not so thick going. So he's talking about textual use of the scripture. I'll paraphrase this. I know it's terrible to read things to people, especially after eating a meal on a hot day. The eyes kind of glaze over, but it's always the case that however Brueggemann says something, I wish I had said it that way, or I wish I could say it that way. I think he says it so much better than I say it, so it's hard to resist trying to paraphrase his statement. But he starts out by saying, the biblical text makes sense. Otherwise we wouldn't study it, we wouldn't preach. Those who do preach using the text wouldn't preach with the text. But having said that it makes sense, it still leaves a lot to be said. On the one hand, for example, it might mean, and it usually means, that the biblical text, or scripture content, fits in with what we already know. That is, it makes sense in terms of the conclusions that we've already drawn, but we've drawn them on other grounds, whether they're horizontal or vertical. And whoever is the influence of 550 in our lives, whatever that is, what we're saying is the text fits with that. It makes sense. It's harmonious. It's not intrusive. So the text then is accepted because it matches our reason, it matches our values, it matches our ideology. And hence it's not abrasive. So he says conservative people use the biblical text this way and make them fit dogmatic or moral judgments that they reached on other grounds and they've previously formulated. That's what conservative people do, but conservative people aren't the only one who come in line for some kind of criticism. Liberal folks do the same kind of thing. They read the text and they affirm the text because the text fits conclusions that they've already drawn based on social sciences or some other field. In either case, sense-making is a way of domesticating, of taming, of limiting the biblical text so that conclusions are drawn about what is to be valued and what is to be affirmed and how decisions are to be made. And then we take the text and we kind of fit it in, and it's domesticated, and the criteria, the norm, are whatever we believed in before we came to the text. So the text comes in last. After everything else has already been settled and decided on from other fields, be they vertical, horizontal, or whatever. Okay, but what he wants to say is that the phrase makes sense can have a different meaning. It can have a meaning which is more dynamic and which is more faithful to the biblical text. A different way of understanding the verb makes sense is to see the text as the subject. And that's what we have over here in number two. The Bible makes, that's a verb, the Bible makes sense. So the text creates sense. The text creates meaning where none existed until the text was read. Well, at least where none existed that was valid until the text was read, and the text announced how things really are. Not how they are in terms of, you know, some other field, whether it's Aristotelian logic, or whatever the philosophical system is, or whatever the value system is. That's all temporal, that's all theoretical, it's all transitory. What the text announces is what really is. Such an approach assumes that the situation is nonsensical, it is absurd, it is meaningless, it is without focus until the text. Now that's making a pretty large claim. We don't all say we go around living in a nonsensical, meaningless, absurd world, although a good many people say, you know, after they pursued it for a long ways, that's what it boils down to. In Faust, Goethe's Faust looked around in the library, you know, after a ripe age and much learning, and said, "So what? What's it all amount to? I'm no further than I was at the beginning." Well, that kind of approach places a very high value on the text. It says that it is the source of disclosure from which the community of faith is to receive a clue about its situation, clues that make living and believing possible. That's a high value on the text. That's pretty well tipped the hand then of the question of the session. Which of these three is the title of the book? Now, before I move on into the content of chapter one, I want to back off a little bit. Are we together? Where are you? Where are we? Does that make sense to you? Because if we go on and that's kind of missing.
Are you going to do the third one where senses emphasize?
Am I going to do that?
I mean, is there a third way to read that phrase where the senses emphasize? Not the text or the making, but what's resulted.
Yeah. Well, let me group these two together, and this one separate, and we can put something of a plus here. That is, the title of the book wants to affirm both of those, but principally, what we're affirming is this. You know, the text is a given because that's there. But that doesn't mean just a literal reading of the text, a flat literal reading. There's something dynamic going on in the process so that the text makes, it creates, it shapes, it formulates sense. Now, I think that's very foreign. It certainly was foreign to me. And so it's hard to make that shift. Well, the first chapter is trying, you know, we'll work through that in a sense. The third one is certainly not what he wants to say. The first chapter is to say this is what the biblical worldview is not. And he has three examples of this, of what it's not. And then he goes on in the rest of the book to unpack this. We can say this is chapter 1, and this up here is like chapters 2 through 10. First chapter, part of what makes it difficult going, is he's telling you something and then saying that's not the way it is. And, you know, that gets to be a little bit confusing. Sense. There are different ways of saying what makes sense. The first one that he deals with, and it's kind of a long title. First one has to do with the modern industrial scientific model. That's a worldview. It's a worldview that I suspect almost all of us live in most of the time. It's a worldview of government and politics. It's a worldview of science. It's a worldview of military. It's a worldview of business. The people who follow this worldview work on Wall Street. The people who follow this worldview work in science laboratories. The people who follow this worldview are children of the enlightenment. Things are knowable. Problems are for solving. The things in this world, what be they chemicals or institutions, the things of this world are for managing. And some people have, they send their pastor off to learn church management. And the people who send their pastor off to learn church management are people who are children of this worldview. Computers come out of this worldview. It is the worldview that I suppose the vast majority of us live in most of the time. Anybody identify with that or think of some ways of illustrating that? Connie?
Well, I had read part of this, and one thing in the book that he goes on to explain, it says that it also includes the notion that life is built on a reliable scheme of performance and reward. Put in traditional language, good people prosper, evil people suffer. It means that everyone and everything is valued for his or her usefulness. That's also part of that.
Yeah. That's part of management, that's part of productivity, so we're valued for what we produce. And when we turn 65 and retire and aren't producing anything anymore, there's a whole crisis of, well, who am I and am I worth anything? Because now I don't get paid for anything, and I'm retired, I'm discharged, and my meaning and my value came from my productivity. We value people because they are competent. We want to hire the most competent people for the job. And so competence is a norm by which people are valued.
He even takes it to the Little League and says those who never get to play as well, never share in the riches of it. The ones that sit on the bench, they suffer from this.
Yeah.
Because they don't get the glory.
If you're not number one, you're nobody. If you're not Terry Bradshaw, we don't know who you are. But I don't follow football much anymore, and I lived by Pittsburgh for a long time, and around Pittsburgh, of course, Terry Bradshaw. If number two is nobody, who remembers number two, you have to be number one, or you ain't nobody. Success and people get depressed and people have struggles because they work hard and then they're not rewarded for it. And what they believe is, if I work hard, if I am good, if I do good, then it will go well with me. And if I put a lot of money into Social Security when I retire, there's supposed to be enough money there for me. That's all part of this system. Okay. Let's see. I can mention a book in the bookstore by John Douglas Hall entitled Lighten Our Darkness. Anybody read that? Recognize it? John Douglas Hall is looking at the situation of the third world in part and saying... the people in the third world look to the United States and the culture and American culture as being where it's at. When you get there, you've got it made. And the way Americans do things is the right way. And so they start to imitate us, thinking that it's going to go well with them. They'll be successful. They'll be prosperous. They'll be happy. And what John Douglas Hall is saying is, well, it's not so. And we need to own up to that. That's the dark side. The failures don't get advertised. Only the successes. Lighten Our Darkness is an attempt to come to grips with our shortcomings and the crises that happen to us individually and collectively when this system doesn't work. But we don't believe that it can't work. We believe it's supposed to work. So when it doesn't, that's a crisis. All right, the second one I want to put up here that he deals with is another worldview. the existentialist model. Anybody know what existentialism is? That's one of those big words out of the 60s. And anybody who went to college is supposed to know the word, you know, throw it around. It's psych or philosophy 101, you learn about existentialism. You know, it's kind of the in thing to be an existentialist. And the word gets thrown around, what does it mean? What?
Do
your own thing. That's probably as good a way of saying it as anything else. Anybody else? What? When you hear the word existentialist, what comes to mind?
Kierkegaard.
Okay, Søren Kierkegaard. He was a Danish theologian, philosopher, psychologist in the early, mid 1800s. Usually called the father of existentialism. Anything else? Okay. Well, let's see. We could do your own thing, or the big word would be now. For the existentialist worldview, there is no concern really with the past. There's no concern with tradition. There's no concern with precedence. Nor is there any concern about the future. We're not really headed any place. There aren't any particular goals we're trying to accomplish. Sartre, who is another name in existentialist literature, really said where we're headed is for nothing, just a big black empty nothing. You know, death is nothingness, and whatever meaning there is in the process of me making a decision right now.